My name is John Rodriguez. I'm 28. Today's date is Saturday, February 1st, 2020. We're in Santa Monica, California. I'm here with Dennis Danziger, and his relationship to me is a friend, also a mentor, but also in the sense of father figure.
My name is Dennis Danziger. I'm 68 years old. Today is Saturday, February the 1st. We're in Santa Monica, California. I'm here with Johnny Rodriguez, who was my student at Venice High School 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and a friend and a surrogate family member.
So something that I was thinking about was, like, the first few days that I remember I was inside, and I remember receiving your letter, and it's still something that I think about, was just, like, what went through your head? What was going on through your head for you to send the letter out? Like, how did you get there?
First of all, remind me where the first letter went to.
This was when I was in the county jail.
Okay, so here in L.A.
Yeah.
So, but when you were in my class, it was my seventh year, about my 17th year of teaching, and I was about 2 years into my teaching English at Venice High School, and the reason I taught, for the most part, is I wanted to hear my students' stories. It was a class about you and my students were the textbook. We kind of put the textbook away. And we focused a lot on short memoir writing, because I wanted to know where my students were from, who they were, what they were about. I didn't really care about their interpretation of literature. And the first essay that you turned in was called A Left and a Right. And it was about you being bored on a Sunday afternoon and going to Burger King. And you got jumped. And it was, I thought to myself, well, this dude read a lot of Hemingway, because it was short, powerful, no frills, and simple on the surface and really deep. And I had taught in South Central. I had taught at the Rich Kids School up at Pali High. I taught at UCLA for summer programs from high school kids from all over the world. And you were only the second student I had ever taught out of maybe 2,500 students who had this extraordinary writing ability. And I was amazed by that. In fact, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but after you wrote that one, I took it home to my wife, Amy Friedman, who's a surrogate family member to you also, and who's been a writer and a teacher all her life on the college level. And I said, read this. And she was amazed by it. And so I thought, he plagiarized. No one's this good. No one at 17 is this good. So we had another assignment, and you came back. It was about you leaving, sneaking out of the house at midnight to go tag a highway sign. And I went, this is really good. This guy's too good. And I went home and I Googled all your work to see if you were cheating. I couldn't find it. So then, not long after that, I gave an assignment in class and said, this is a timed essay. And it was total nonsense. I just wanted to catch you cheating. And I gave you the assignment, and I read it, and I took it home to Amy, and I went, this guy's really good. And she went, I think he's a savant. And I didn't want to lose contact with you. I didn't want that talent to die just because we were physically separated. So I wrote.
I don't know. It's weird too, because I do think about at the moment I don't know what that meant, right? What the impact of that would be was to have somebody who meant nothing to me at the time, who was for no reason, had no reason to be included in my life, especially somebody who at the time didn't. First of all, let's go back a bit, but for somebody who you had a belief, and I learned this later, that I didn't do some of the things that I did, that you believed that I was just in a bad situation, that it was just misfortune. And to find out that, no, this was a part of me, that I did engage in certain things. I not explicitly belonged to a community, but indirectly. And for you to, like, know that I had committed a certain type of crime, and for you to be like, okay, I'm still going to choose to write this person. That for me was just like, at the time, again, I didn't know what that meant. But just thinking about it now, like, I sit back sometimes right now and I'm just like, what if this person did not continue to write me?
I'm glad it was impactful for you. To be honest, it wasn't that difficult for me. You know, it was like, there's this guy who had enormous talent and he's sitting in county. And what does it hurt if I reach out? Right? I mean, if you'd been out with the flu or mono for 4 or 5 weeks, wouldn't I have reached out anyway? Wouldn't any decent teacher would have reached out and go, how are you doing? When are you coming back? What's going on?
Probably not.
Okay. Well, you know what? Something else just occurred to me. I said there was two extraordinary students, writing students, and many, many gifted students, but two that were just like off the chart. I couldn't figure it out. I don't know if I've ever mentioned him to you. His name is Dylan Henry. Did I ever mention Dylan to you?
I don't think so.
Dylan was at Pali High, and he was the first of the two brilliant writers. And he came in sort of like you did. He read the first thing he wrote, and I was like, who's this guy? Where's this kid come from? No one's this gifted. No one's this smart and sweet. The summer before his senior year, he died in a car wreck on Sunset Boulevard. And maybe the loss of Dylan, that I'd have two beautiful superstar writers who I knew were going to grow up to be professional writers. He wanted to be, and I know he would have been. And the idea that I lost one of them, maybe the idea that I just couldn't bear the idea of losing both of them. So that might have motivated me to write. I don't know. But I had spoken to your mother. I had met your sister. And, of course, my wife, Amy Friedman. I knew nothing of incarceration before I married her. Before she was married to me, she was married to a man inside in Canada, raised her two daughters, and taught me what it was like to be the mother of children who have an incarcerated parent. So I had a little background, emotional, and they've become my stepdaughters who I love. So I knew the impact of incarceration. And then we began to write.
Yeah.
Was it difficult to write back?
Not really. No, I think it wasn't difficult to write, I think it's weird that I think at that age, I think I'm only, 19 years old? I think at that age, for me to, like, intentionally try not to write you, just because, one, like, I just try to separate myself from everybody, because in my head, I'm like, I'm in this for the long haul. I won't be home until I'm 38. I'm not going to drag other people in this with me. And that was kind of my mentality. And it was just like, that was the hard part. The hard part was to not write, because I would force myself not to write. And it felt shitty. But then even without responding, sometimes you'll still send letters.
Yeah, I will not be ignored. And I knew that you like to read, that you like to write. And it just, I'm out here, I'm still teaching. I see students every day. And the same thing happened when I went to your classroom at Venice High, that when I returned to Pali High after Dylan passed away, is I felt the presence when I walked in the classroom. I missed Dylan. I missed you. I wouldn't ever let anyone sit in Dylan's seat. I would never let anyone sit in your seat. It was like, you know, it was like these were sacred spots in an otherwise overcrowded, not particularly pretty public classroom. But my concern as we continued, and I remember when you got out and we went to, I kept all your letters and I kept copies of mine. And we went to Kinko's, and I actually have the receipt with me. We photocopied all the pages, and we had written 264 pages back and forth to each other over this time. But my thought was, do you want to hear what's going on in my life? Do you want to hear what's going on with my, with Amy and me, with our puppies? Do you want to know what's going on at school? Do you care about the Venice High football game? Mm-hmm. Or do you not want to know anything about the outside because you're away from it? So that was the always thought, what do I say?
Yeah, that to me was like, I didn't even know what to say or anything. And I remember the first time we went to go out to eat, and I got there like 30 to 45 minutes early.
You're always 30 to 45. It's early at all your appointments.
And then I remember just sitting in the car, and just waiting and thinking about it. Trying to picture what is it that you would look like. And for me, it was something...
I was still old.
You look the same, but what was so hard, and I don't think I don't know if I ever mentioned it to you, but... And I did this with several people, but you were probably one of my top folks that I did it with, was to think about... I had to convince myself in my head, I had to program this in my head, that when I came home, you wouldn't be alive.
Well, that was possible. I forget how old I was when you went in, but 22 years plus, however old I was, there was a really good chance I wouldn't still be here.
And so when I came home and we used to have dinner that one time, like, I don't know, it felt like I was cheating death or something, like somebody's death. I didn't feel comfortable because I know that I was. It wasn't supposed to be about, like, the minimum of at least 10 years before I went home, maybe 15. And it just felt, it sucked because I know that this is something that many other folks would not have. And so to walk with that, to know that, I just felt like, I don't know, there's like a weird like guilt that you feel because I'm just like.
Survivor's guilt or?
Kinda, yeah. And it's just like, why me? Why am I, why can I still see this person that I love?
Right.
When I know these other folks likely won't. But then seeing you, it just felt like, I don't know. I'm like, is this really happening?
I hate the word surreal. It's my least favorite word because it's overused. Seeing you in the parking lot and having dinner with you and Amy was surreal.
Yeah,
I can still see it. So speaking of not recognizing somebody, when I went to visit you and you were in New Folsom Prison, and I had never been inside before, and I was the last visitor in because instead of going to New Folsom, I went to Folsom and because I just got completely lost. And you were standing at the base of the steps or this plank kind of in the waiting area, which was like kind of an ugly bus station waiting area. It was Visitor's Day. There were a lot of parents there with their sons and loved ones. And you were the only person there waiting. I didn't know who you were. Did I ever tell you that?
You mentioned it.
I didn't know who you were. You had lost a lot of weight. I had remembered you as being kind of round, right? Slightly overweight. And though you had lost a lot of weight. You were thin. And your hair was really long. And I know you were studying and reading much about your Native American roots, but you looked very Native American. Much more so than the Johnny I knew at Venice High School. And so when we sat down, I began to pepper you with questions to make sure it was you. Like, which middle school did you go to? And who did you sit with in my class? And, you know, I just asked you, I interviewed you because for a while I wasn't sure.
Yeah,
it was weird. And this is what I remembered most about that day. And I don't know how long you had been inside, maybe.
Two, three years.
Whatever it does, prison does to people, you were not able to ask for anything. I was going, can I buy you a Coke? Can I buy you a bottle of water? How about a sandwich? How about a Snickers bar? And it was like whatever life force that you had before you went in, you couldn't ask. It was that was the painful part of the day. It's like something that happened. The only thing you asked for was if I could get you kind of a subscription to the LA Times, which is very difficult to get in, a subscription of anything to inside.
Yeah.
But I want to jump, if we can jump, because that was 2 years in.
Mm-hmm.
And in 15 weeks, you're going to graduate from UCLA with a degree in English literature and a grade point average of off the chart. What is it?
For now, it's safe at 3.9, but that might change. But
out of four. Oh, it might go up?
No, it might go down. Okay.
And what's that jump feel like? Are you still processing freedom?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think I jumped in really quickly, which is a good thing. But it's also it's weird. It was weird because, like, I felt like there's like this weird gap. It feels like, one, I have to play catch up. Mm-hmm. Two, like, I'm surrounded by people that I really care about, but it feels like I can't spend time with them. So it's really like the separation and the barriers are still there. And I just went from like one institution into another. And it's lovely. Like, it's lovely in the sense that, like, I remember doing correspondence courses inside and I was like, fuck, I wish I could have a professor. I wish I could ask this person about this question or whatnot. And then now I have the opportunity to raise my hand and, one, to be called by my first name. And then to, like, ask questions. And then afterwards, they ask me questions. Like, they're the ones that want to follow up with me, which is very, very weird, but also really nice. And it just feels like it feels very, very surreal still. And I think that's why I'm kind of scared to just pause for a little bit. Because I have a feeling that there are things that I haven't really sat down with all the way. And it just feels, it feels shitty in the sense that, like, I wish I could be more intentional with my time and be there for people, but, like, school doesn't allow me to be.
So what happened inside in those 8 years that you went from being, other than my English class, not a stellar student at Venice High School? Mm-hmm. You were a 5-year senior, right? To graduating with honors in a few weeks from UCLA. What happened intellectually, educationally, inside that pushed you into reading and writing in academia and thought and completely resurrecting yourself? What happened?
One, it was just like a bunch of support from people like you who, for some reason, and I still ask, why did y'all care about me? But when I didn't care about myself, I knew that other folks were. And once I started doing that, I think I was very, very fortunate in the sense that I wasn't a complete dumbass. I made dumbass decisions. But I had the ability to process, to, like, really grasp material. And so when I went inside and I got to the first college program, I seen that there was people that didn't have that ability. And when I saw that, I don't know why I feel, like, guilty a lot, but I just felt like I know folks that can't even read the letters that people send to them. And so to me, to, like, try to help them, it just felt good to see them, like, finally have the ability to do some of the things, to process language, to know what it is that they were engaging with. And then also seeing the faces of surprise on people, especially a lot of the correctional officers, when deep down they make you feel like shit, they make you feel like you cannot do anything. And then to see the look on their face when they're like, damn, these folks are actually doing something. That was really, it fueled me. And one, not for me, but to make it accessible to other people, because I seen that if folks are engaging with certain things, if I can keep their mind away from the bullshit that's happening on the yard, if I can keep them engaged in writing, if I can keep them engaged in whatever subjects, I see that little change, a little spark coming in. Right. And then little by little, you got a bunch of little sparks, and then you got a little flame. And we start building as a community who first didn't even talk to each other. And then you got black and brown and yellow and white folks all reaching out. Hey, can I borrow your textbook? Can I do this? And to see that, and to see an actual functioning, like, living community, that was, that's what did it for me. And so I keep that with me. And when I always tell folks, they're like, I send pictures inside, and they're like, hey, you're at UCLA, you're doing this. And I'm like, no, we're at UCLA, because I carry y'all with me. And I'll make sure you get here. So,
well, you've carried other people. And so when I visited you at New Folsom, and we'd been corresponding, I came back to LA a day or two later. And a few days after that, you wrote a letter to me. I have it. And this letter, just the way you touch these people's lives who were in your classes, that was at Ironwood State, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the letter you wrote, dated March 3rd, 2012. Maybe you could just read the first paragraph or so.
I haven't seen this in years.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's see. Dear students, thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm sure you're asking yourself, why am I reading this? Or why do I have to listen to this crap? This guy's a loser. He's in prison, not me. You're right. But please allow me a few minutes of your time. I was a kid once, in those same shoes that you stroll in. I used to sit in that same classroom and probably the same desk that you're in. Which I learned that they're not. I watched kids sitting in their desks, staring at the clock, hoping the bell would ring to end the period. I saw classmates take their phones out, checking to see if they received a text from their buddy standing at the other end of the classroom. I heard Mr. Dandiger tell stories about him catching kids doing lines of coke in the back of the classroom, or having parents trying to sue him because he failed the student who honestly earned an F on their report card. What I remember most about the class were the journals. Mr. Dandiger would give us 10 minutes each day to scribble anything we wanted on a piece of paper. Not many teachers gave us that freedom. They always told us what to do and how to do it. Our journals were private, sacred, free from other eyes and people who would criticize our writing. It was lovely.
And so this is like a 3-page letter. It's well over 1,000 words, and it ends, and this is, I'm going to read the last. So please take these words into consideration. Don't be like me, wishing I could retrace my steps. Your time is now. Make the right decisions before it's too late. If you don't want to get an education to satisfy someone else, do it for yourself. Prove to everyone who put you down that you can achieve something. If not for these reasons, do it for me. You'll be able to say you made a prisoner smile, which is something I don't do quite often. I enjoy it, though. Thank you for your time. Best wishes, Johnny Rodriguez. So I got this letter. I took it to all my classes. I read it to all my classes. And in my last period of the day, there was a young lady named Kara, who would come in and put her head flat on the desk. She wasn't high. She wasn't stoned. She was just exhausted from life. And she had a zero average. She had never done any work in my class. She never looked up. People hadn't seen her face. And I read this entire letter. And when I finished with those words, she sat up and she raised her hand and she said, my brother's in New Folsom. I wonder if he knows Johnny. But he's there on a parole violation, so it's not a big deal. But, you know, sometimes we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday and we drive all the way up to New Folsom. It takes 6 hours. And we get there. There's a lockdown. My brother hasn't done anything. But then we have to turn around and get all the way back. And she talked about what it was like to be the sister, family member of someone who was incarcerated. And everyone in the class was honed in on what she said. And she kept talking and talking. Now, you remember high school? Anything over, if a student talks for more than 20 seconds, it's an aria, right? No one. She talked for about 7 minutes. I kept looking, going, should I stop her? But, like, they were listening to her more than they ever listened to me, right? And so, and she gave this talk. She came alive because of this letter.
Mm-hmm.
I went home. I gave it to Amy. I told her what happened. And she said, we're going to start a club for students whose lives have been impacted by incarceration, and which we did, and which you know, it's called mm-hmm. POPS now. It mm-hmm. stands for Pain of the Prison System. And I think back of all the people when you talk about the community that you created inside of writing. Because of this letter, because of Amy's background with incarceration being the wife, because of Scott Budnick,
mm-hmm.
whose mentor, mover, shaker,
mm-hmm.
who's part of the reason you're here, we started this club It started out at Venice High School in my class with Amy and I making brownies. I said, anybody whose life has been impacted by incarceration, come to my class at lunch. We started out with 10 people in my class. We made brownies and peanut butter sandwiches. That was 7 years ago this month. And now we're in 14 schools in L.A. and New York and Pennsylvania and Atlanta. And your letter and these other people, Amy, Scott Budnick, mm-hmm. are the spark of POPs. And now over 1,000 students have, we serve over 1,000 students. You're, you know, the anthologies we publish, you're in the anthologies. 1,000 students have written their stories, their raps, their memoirs, published their artwork, their photography. And you were part of the drive. That letter has touched now 1,000 POPs kids coast to coast and growing all the time. So I hadn't expected that when I read your 400-word essays in my class, mm-hmm. but kind of the beauty of writing is if you write something, you feel it, you work on your craft, you put it out there, you never know where it's going to land.
Yeah.
So you've told me, with this 3.9 UCLA average, you're going to do what with it? What's the next step?
I'm trying to figure that out. It's scary.
Yeah.
One, because I'm like... I'm used to being a student. I like it. I like being in the classroom because I've been away from it for so long. But I don't know because, like, I'm getting, like, feedback from folks. I'm hearing folks. I know what I want to do.
Folks feeding you back.
Like, a lot of it has to do with financial stuff, about with time. Like, should I go to get a graduate degree or should I go for a PhD? What's more affordable? And at the end of the day, I'm just like, I'm gonna go back inside prison. I want to use literature to help people, one, to understand their histories, because that helped me a lot once I was able to tap into that. It really helped me just get comfortable with myself, understanding where I was coming from, and not be confused, like as confused, because I'm still confused. But
you're confused about?
No, there's just things. Like, I'm always not 100% sure of myself.
It's a good place to be if you're a writer.
But just, I want to do that, provide that, like, here, these are your histories. But also, I think it's important to understand, to kind of pretty much, it's modeling what you did. Just having, allowing somebody the ability to just talk, say your story, own it. But one thing that I want to do is further it is embody it. So probably use performance art. And another piece of it I think is important is to not do it on an individual level, but work with the folks around you. Because I've seen that that's when, like, I feel most comfortable. When I'm, like, super uncomfortable, but I run into a group of strangers, and it's just like, okay, let's put the bullshit aside. Let's figure out who we are. And then that's when everything just moves at ease. So that's what I'm,
Well, you're going to be, wherever you teach, whether it's inside or high school or college, wherever, you're going to be really good. Because I've seen you. I've seen you when you've come to POPs meetings, both at Venice and El Camino. I don't know where else. We're always trying to grab you to be a guest speaker. But I've always moved that when you come back, how you connect with the students at these POPs meetings. And I'm wanting to know what happens for you when you come back to the classroom, when you came back to our classroom for the first time and since.
Well, it just feels like good, one, to be back. And then two, it's also a little weird, not in a bad way. And I won't use surreal because you don't like that word. but like that's a younger version of me sitting in front of me. And although for some reason, like, the farther you're away from being released from incarceration, the more I think, like, the world challenges you to stay in tune with yourself. But I do try to bring myself back and just, like, put myself in their position. Like, remember what it was to feel like this. Like, what was going on? What were the feelings? What didn't I care about?
What was going on?
Which is like, I was unhappy with myself. I was unhappy with my situation. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that likely would not have graduated on time. And then also the financial expectation of, like, being an adult, right? Like, technically, legally classified as an adult.
I'd like to know more like that, because schools really push college. Mm-hmm. And we know only 30% of the people in the country mm-hmm. go to college. And we know it's extraordinarily expensive. So what happens in the mind of you when you're a teenager, or other people you know, young people, when you have that pressure and you know that's what you're supposed to do, but it seems insurmountable?
Well, I didn't really know, like, the only college I had heard about was Santa Monica. I thought that was like Harvard or some shit. I didn't know, which is a community college, which...
It's a very good community college.
Community colleges are awesome and very financially smart decisions. But at the time, like, that wasn't going through my head. College wasn't a thought.
And did you have a thought of what you would be doing the day after you graduated at the age of 18? No.
I wasn't thinking that far. I was just, like, more concerned about just the day-to-day.
And you were working?
Working, taking care of my little brothers and sisters. Right. I would actually surprisingly look forward to writing to your assignments. That was about the only thing.
And I remember after you turned in one of these, I think it was your third essay, and I said, "Dude, what do you read?" And you looked at me like, "Huh? Like, what do you read?" I went, "Louis J. Rodriguez, Jimmy Santiago Baca, Gary Soto, stop me when I mention a Chicano writer, you know." And it was just, you didn't read. You said, "I read the sports section when you bring the LA Times in." So my question that I've never asked is, where did this writing talent come from? If you weren't reading avidly or at all when you were a teenager, were you writing?
No, I don't think I was writing. I think I was drawing more.
Okay.
And I think... I don't know. I think it was always this, like, this ability to, like, mimic things, right? Like, to kind of, like, externally show that shit is okay. And I did that through many ways. One of them was, like, I guess you're the ability to detail. You know what's real. And so, like, you know how to kind of focus people's attention elsewhere. So when things are going on in the home or we're moving or everything's hectic at home, you're just, like, you show up and you show up to class and, like, no, everything's good. And so I think that ability is what came in. And then the first where I think I started, like, channeling or, like, processing that some way was through tagging and through drawing. And that was a way to kind of let that out. And that was, like, my way of storytelling in the beginning.
And I just popped in my head. Do you write? Do you have friends who are inside who you're still connected to? And I want to know about what you write. What you write, what they want to hear. And I think that, what would you tell people who are listening about the people you know who you're contacting, you're still in contact with, who are inside?
Well, for me, like, I don't watch TV out here. And I'm always, for some reason, like, there's so much stuff going on, and people, especially people I was asked, like, "Oh, you went to go do this, or you visited this place, like, how awesome and whatnot." And realistically, and I tell them, especially if I trust them, or sometimes I think a lot of people look at me oddly just because I'm like, I really don't care about this other place or that I ran into this superstar or this and that. Like, I really don't care. Like, for me, like, when I get a letter, it lights me up. Like, I get to, like, get away from the world for a bit and just, like, be there, be present. And to read and just kind of be reminded, like, hey, like, these connections aren't lost. And so we just write about, like regular conversation. It's really nothing. And then a lot of the times, too, I had to remind myself that sometimes, like, when I write back as a writer, I know this is wrong, but I try to, like, cover myself, right? Mm-hmm. It's to kind of, like, censor some of the things that I'm doing. And because, one, I'm, like, I don't want to accidentally say something that will make somebody feel bad, which would, like, hey, I visited this place, or these are the things I'm doing. But then again, I get reminded, and I know how it is, where I have my friends, and they're like, no, tell me what the fuck you're doing. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to hear about it.
Right.
And recently I sent like a stack of photos to my friend, and I just got a letter this morning. I mean, last night that I read this morning. And Ugo was like, thank you for that little journey. Because it was about like 30 pictures,
mm-hmm.
and just showing him and writing on the back of them and just telling him, hey, this is this person, with little bios and everything. And he was just like, it was nice to do that for a little bit.
I got two more questions before we call it a day. One is, if we would come back here 4 or 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what is it you want to write that you haven't written? What form?
What form?
Oh, yeah, what form? Do you have that manuscript in your mind of what of what's inside you? You're in school full-time right now. You're not able to write creatively 2, 3, 4 hours a day. What's the piece in your mind that you wish to write one day that's still inside you?
I think it's I don't know. I don't have like a master plan. But I think at the end of the day, I just want to, I like seeing people connect. I like seeing people connect, and one, especially through hardship, in all types of ways or forms. And I think earlier we were even talking about like my little brother, and I like going through now I'm on this end going through the court system, right? Being a supporter, and he's fighting his trial. And then also like seeing the other side, right? Like the people who are affected by this, the families. I don't want to use victims because kind of degrades them in a sense, but those people to see at the end of the day that no matter what was being done through a court process or through a system, like we're all hurting, right? Like if my brother goes away for a long time and the other folks who lost a child, like we're all fucked in the end, and I want to uplift that, like we're hurting but we can heal and we can heal together. And really I want to just bring understanding and like some peace with whatever I do. And that would be like my next project. I don't know what it is. I kind of was thinking about maybe a community play where folks from the community from certain types of backgrounds can connect, right? Which in a place where they likely wouldn't have, and work together, build your stories, build your narratives, come together. And I don't want to write it. I want them to write it.
I think you have your next project.
Yeah.
That's a great project. Community. I said I had two questions, but I have three. I know I was part of your community. Amy Friedman was part of your community. Mm-hmm. Scott Budnick was an important part of your community.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Brown commuted your sentence as part of your community. How many people had their metaphorical arms around you to lift you, to help lift you? You did the work. I always say you wrote your way to freedom. When you were inside, but how many other people, who am I missing?
I think it's the people who go unnoticed, who do small, simple acts, in the sense that you can have one correctional officer who makes you feel like a human again.
Mm.
And it could just be one movement, right? Mm. One word, or say, hey, how you doing? Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
To like people who you probably never interacted with. So I know it's like not everybody's visible.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's what's been those are the folks involved. It's hard to grasp everybody. I can't mention everybody, but we affect folks that we don't think we will. Yeah.
I promise this is my last question.
Yeah.
you're going to graduate from UCLA in May of this year?
In June.
June. How many tickets you get for graduation?
We get about 4, I think.
Okay.
5. And okay. You will have one.
Are Amy and I on the list?
Yes.
Are you going to scalp these tickets?
Yes.
Okay.
I might like bombard you and make you have to come to like 2 or 3 graduations.
Okay.
So our department, and then for underground scholars, and then so that way y'all. Yeah.
We'll be there. We were when you got your AA degree inside it. Ironwood State Prison was a very moving day and a very special day for us. Yeah. So UCLA would be better because we can go out and eat afterwards.
Yep. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. Thank you for having this conversation with me.
Thank you, Dennis, for everything. Love you.
Same.